Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Dr. Clifton Chan is a physiotherapist with a special interest in the health of performing artists. In particular, he works with musicians and hypermobile dancer patients. You can find him in his Potts Point clinic. Clifton also teaches up-and-coming physiotherapists at Macquarie University in Sydney. And today we are talking about hypermobility and what it means for performing artists. So, Clifton, welcome this afternoon to the Prepoint Pod. Thank you very much for coming on.
No, thank you for your invite.
So, Clifton, you are a physiotherapist by trade, You specialize in two very unique and key areas, treating performing artists and also treating people with hypermobility syndromes. Firstly, I'm interested for you to tell us about yourself and also your interest in performing arts healthcare.
Yeah, so my interest in this area grew from playing violin growing up. And then wanting to do it even in university, but got told that being a performing artist is really hard by my own parents. And so they encouraged me not to pursue it as a professional avenue. And so I went into physio, but then tried to prove them wrong. And so during physio school, I did music school at night and enrolled in the Masters of Music. And then throughout it, I found that so many of my classmates were injured, like more than half of them were injured. And because I was the resident physio, everyone was coming up to me asking for advice. And so here goes 1 year, 2 year, some of my colleagues still have the same injury from when they first started their degree. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. And then I saw a wonderful advert in the APA, the Australian Physiotherapy Association magazine, advertising for a PhD candidate looking at the professional orchestral musician injuries in Australia. And I went, I need to do this. And it's working with Dr. Bronwyn Ackerman, and who, you know, everybody knows, is one of the first physios really sort of doing this in a research capacity with the 8 state symphony orchestras. And so this was a great opportunity, and I had one semester left to do a research project. I'm like, forget that. I'm just going to graduate early and do a PhD in the area. And so that's how I got myself in there. And then things led to another. I started to join the Australian Society of Performing Arts Healthcare and then the American version, PAMA. And then through that, got amazing collaborative opportunities with people who worked with dancers. And that's how my hypermobility interest grew from there. So yeah, that's how I got into the field. And yeah, my physiotherapy sort of background led me to more occupational health, occupational medicine. My other supervisor during my PhD was Professor Tim Driscoll, who's an epidemiologist and occupational health person. And my love for this area just grew.
That's an awesome start to your career. So it is so interesting when I think you can see the influence that healthcare can have on performing arts firsthand, and that That must have been a little bit difficult for you, because I know, obviously, being, you know, a new physiotherapy student, you feel a bit overwhelmed by everything that you're learning, and you feel as though you should be able to help these people, but at the same time, you're like, hang on a minute, I need some time to work this out for myself.
Right. Especially like coming out as a new graduate, looking at the evidence, I'm like, oh my goodness, I didn't know that musicians got injured this much, because no one talked about it when you're going through high school. And I'm sure people did, but you know, they just dropped off, but no one stayed to talk about it. And the teachers never told you anything. And so then I looked in the research, I'm like, there's nothing here. Oh, Bronwyn Ackerman's name came up a few times, but that's it. Like, there was nothing to guide management, and the advice, I couldn't tailor my advice. I had to really adapt it from all other sports evidence.
I suppose also with dancers, it's probably the same for musicians. There's a very much a show must go on kind of mentality too, in performing arts. So do you think that that might have been part of the reason that you didn't know about it until you were immersed in it?
I think so. I think, you know, I always hung around the elite groups, or the people who are super passionate at what they do, and they would do whatever it takes to make the show go on. I still remember myself in year 12 going through music extension, and during halfway through the recital, the air conditioner turned on in the entire building and blew music, and I was playing off memory, so it blew music everywhere, and I was shocked, and that's always stayed in my memory, and it interrupted me, and I couldn't play from memory, like in a performance capacity, for a long time. And another player, a trumpeter, I remember in my year 12, had performance anxiety, but no one knew what it was. So we just saw her crying or shaking in backstage and thought, oh, she must be going through some trauma or family issues, but no one knew of anything. So in hindsight, these were the things that happened. But yeah, the show must go on. We just have to push on and bury it until, you know, you get through it.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I guess in the time since you've graduated and finished those 2 degrees at the same time, just casually, I'm guessing, you know, through joining ASPR and, you know, being a practitioner yourself, you've seen some change. What are some of the things, this might be going a bit off track, but what are some of the things that you have seen change over those years?
Thanks for asking that question. That's just given me goosebumps all over. I'm going, wow, there actually has been change. Mm-hmm. Probably the biggest change is at the top end. So Bronwyn and you know, the sound practice team has really drafted a occupational work and safety sort of type of booklet induction manual for orchestras around Australia. From a other organization perspective, Australian National Academy of Music has a health and well-being wellness module in their entire time that candidates are there. I've been quarterly invited down to run 2 or 3 day sort of clinics and talks at small group and individual level. The orchestras now still sometimes contact us during lockdown, for example. They know the musicians were coming out of lockdown and they will be increasing and ramping up their playing. Mm. And they asked for some online streaming workshops and things like that I ran, like Melbourne Symphony. Even the Australian sort of Air Force or the Army music band asked for a presentation as well. So we see that this is the awareness, number one.
Yeah,
people acknowledge it now and are much more open to talking about it. So that is improving, and I've definitely seen that. And now more healthcare practitioners, I don't have to like have just, you know, the few numbers on my phone to call. There are now more practitioners all over Australia. And it's great to see that music is catching up to dance a little bit and sort of being a little bit more proactive, having things that are more mainstay rather than band-aid fixing that perspective. So yeah, it's quite encouraging, but it's still got a long way to go, but important steps in the last 10 years that I've been researching this area.
Yeah, I think that's really important to reflect and see sort of how far, I guess, yeah, both musicians' health but also and dancers' health has come in that time. And then it's exciting really for the future, because you know now that there is such a growing network of people who can help, and to be part of that's even better.
Exactly, like yourself. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. So this is it's really great to talk to you, because I feel like we have a lot of things in common, and that there's probably like a certain prevalence of hypermobile musicians and hypermobile dancers. Can you tell us a little bit about what hypermobility is, and how do you know how prevalent it is in dancers and in musicians? Like,
yeah, so that's two interesting questions. So something's going to be published in the next month or so, where an international group of researchers in hypermobility actually has come to a consensus on what hypermobility is. So that's getting published next month. Leslie led it and I was the senior author on it. And it's very exciting that the Australians led the way, but it was an input from international collaborators. And now we do recognize hypermobility as an increase in range of motion of a joint. So just keeping that quite simple, and that it is could be the articular surface. So someone's born with more articular cartilage, so there's more surface to move. The ligaments are a bit more lax. And that's hyper though, is we should reserve that for like the top sort of 5% of the population. It needs to be excessive. Okay, so it's not the normal population. I mean, the person could be healthy and normal, but we're talking about just the hypermobility of that joint should be excessive compared to their peers that are relevant in terms of their age and sex. So hypermobility based on age and sex and ethnicity should be excessive. So top 5%. And then if we want to talk about generalized joint hypermobility, is that someone's got hypermobility ideally in four more joints of the body, and ideally in not just the arm and not just the leg, but somewhere in the arm, somewhere in the leg, and somewhere in the spine.
Yeah, okay. I guess two sort of different ideas of, or two different classifications for two different classes of hypermobility or diagnoses of hypermobility.
So with hypermobility, we're trying to not use the word diagnosis, because it's not a disease or disorder or anything, because it's just really a description. So you could have one joint that's hypermobile, and you can have many joints that are hypermobile, but they're all asymptomatic. And that's sort of the good news. Most people with hypermobility are asymptomatic, go through most of their life with no problems, unless you know, get bumped or something in your hypermobile joint and it becomes symptomatic. But most people actually with hypermobility don't have problems, and that's the best thing about this.
Yeah, it's, I think clinically I see dancers told that they're hypermobile and it becomes almost a little bit of a panic factor, but I guess if something is hurting, like, you know, somebody could be hypermobile or not hypermobile and still have a painful joint. It's not necessarily a cause for alarm. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely not no cause for alarm. But, and then you just consider it if you're doing a certain type of activity. We know if you're doing contact sports and you're hypermobile, and depends on which joint that's hypermobile, then you could potentially do some strengthening to increase the stability, the active stability around a joint, or increase your awareness, so your proprioception and things like that. But it isn't cause for alarm, and we don't have strong enough data that, you know, people who are hypermobile do have significant increases in injury in lots of things. And maybe contact sports is the place where we're particularly aware, and probably we can say hypermobile people are at increased risk of injury, but in most other things it isn't. But we don't have enough good strong data to support that.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important take-home message. So on that note, can hypermobility actually be a good thing?
It absolutely can. It can be protective, because if you've already got the natural turnout, for example, from the hips, that external rotation and abduction, then you're not compensating with twisting or increasing rotation at the knee, and therefore you don't stress the ligaments there. So yeah, it can be protective. Where we see people who don't have it at the hips, they'll compensate elsewhere, and that's when, you know, other things can happen. And you know, we don't have great knee rotation muscle strength.
Yeah. And
not easy. It's not easy to retrain rotation of the knee, you know. The hamstrings, you know, we need to teach the hamstrings to better control, a bit like a horse controlling a horse's head, you know, with two hamstrings on the side. That's not that easy. So you know, having strong hips is great, but having hypermobile hips and having that range at the hips is really amazing. So
things like turnout and développé and arabesque splits.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, just having the knees, if you've got hyperextension of the knee, then you don't have to stress, you know, the posterior capsule of the knee, for example. But then you, yeah, but the big message here is, just because you've got that range doesn't mean you've used it either.
Yeah, true. So, yeah, before you were talking about increasing active stability at a joint, and I guess like that active stability comes from muscles. So having strong muscles that can control the hypermobility, it means your muscles probably need to work a little bit harder, I guess, to control the range of movement that you have, because you have more than the average person, right?
You do. And I mean, it does work harder initially, but if you train long enough, then the muscle gets bigger. And then again, it's maximum voluntary contraction, the MVC does reduce again. So you just grow bigger muscles and it works at a lower capacity. It's a bit like practice and training, right? If you're going to perform 10 push-ups, but if you can do 20, doing 10 is effortless. So that's what we just need to train. And, you know, that end of range, your hypermobile range, we really absolutely should stop being scared of it. I mean, if someone naturally has it, it's normal for their body. So, you know, you can go into it, work into it, but it's just, again, what I said, don't abuse it. Don't like go into like rapid and go really fast into it and go bone on bone smash into it. Or in, you know, taking biomechanics lessons, you know, if we're weight bearing for a joint, you want bone surfaces to be well aligned. So you've got maximum contact between two contact, you know, cartilage surfaces. So you want to align it. You don't want to be in your for example, extend, like doing a push-up, you want to align your arms so they're not in hyperextension when you're at the top all the time, because that's not smart. So it's about learning how to use it, strengthening into the hypermobile range, and yeah, having strength there. So especially open chain activities, there's no reason why you don't strengthen into the hypermobile range with open chain activities.
This makes me feel better about myself at the gym, always trying to control my overhead press with my hypermobile elbows. It's okay if they accidentally go beyond neutral.
Absolutely. You should.
When I'm working, you know, treating patients, mobilizing patients, they definitely probably go into my hypermobile range. So I'll just see that as a functional task.
Sure.
Yeah. So I guess sometimes, yeah, like I love the way that you explain the fact that you're trying to align joint surfaces, and that's kind of what helps create stability as well. So sometimes when we're pushing into like knee hyperextension, for example, or elbow hyperextension, because the joint surfaces aren't aligned, like does that then change the capacity of the muscle to produce force around the joint? This is a very technical question.
Yeah. I mean, the short answer is yes, you're probably correct, because in your hypermobile range, depending on which muscle, you know, the agonist or the antagonist that you're activating, they're either in a more shortened or more lengthened range. So unless you train them there, they don't get stronger. So if you're not used to that movement in that end of range, then you have very little strength. So that's why I said really learn to strengthen it in that range. But as with alignment, you want forces to travel in straight lines. And that's how you allow, you know, forces to, I guess, transfer through the body. And that's how you don't injure joints, because you're not loading one specific area. We all know that pressure equals force over area. You want maximum area. So you reduce the pressure on joint surfaces. So when you're in your hypermobile range, usually there's less contact between the two surfaces.
Yeah, that's, I guess that's sort of leading into my next question is like, what are some concerns that hypermobile dancers have? And I guess often it can be hard to actually get stronger because of the excessive range that you have to control with your muscles. But I guess proprioception and sensing where your joints are in space, if you have more contact of a joint surface, I'm guessing that that's actually then harder to control because there's more to control. Is that also that's correct?
Right. Yeah. If you've got more range, you've got more work to do. And so, yeah, and sensing is, we do have pretty frequent data. It's not strong, but multiple studies have said proprioception is a little bit worse. And, you know, you've just got probably more range in a joint to represent in your brain as well. So all of that's harder. But another interesting thing that no one thinks about is self-image when you are hypermobile. Often people who are hypermobile may not consider themselves hypermobile, especially dancers. When they're in an environment where lots of people are hypermobile, they go, I'm not hypermobile, look at them.
I'm yeah. Like, yeah.
Like, no, you are hypermobile.
Yeah.
So this is relevant to you.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, actually. It was a few years ago now at the ballet company that I work at, we actually did some testing with the dancers. And I think one of the other things that, you know, dancers worry about is not being hypermobile. And is that a disadvantage for you when you're a dancer? And it was really interesting because we found that, like, probably the company were represented on a bell curve. So I guess, like, in terms of averages, like a bell curve, most people sit in the middle of the bell curve and then a few people sit out toward the tail ends. And it was exactly like that in the company. So some of the professional dancers were at that extreme end of hypermobility, whereas some of them were at the extreme end of not like being hypermobile. Most of them sat somewhere in the middle. And I don't really know if it was, you know, skewed. I can't quite remember exactly the statistics, but it sort of goes to show that whilst a lot of dancers are hypermobile, and generally it can be like easier for you to sort of get to those positions, like you were saying, like having good turnout and probably even pointing your foot far enough, it's still possible to have a career in dance when you're not at that extreme end. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, your body, as I said earlier, does compensate. And if you learn the compensations and know what your compensations are and you strengthen it up, then you protecting yourself and it becomes okay. And it becomes okay for your body because you're slowly increasing those compensations and you're aware of them and you're strengthening and talking to your health exercise professionals about it. So you're aware, you're not just putting your body on the line and not looking after it.
Mm. And I guess this is another aside question too, but is it the same for musicians? Is being hypermobile advantageous for musicians?
I think very similar to dancers. It depends on what joint. Joint specific. So, you know, musicians like to have that hypermobility between the first finger and the second finger, between the thumb and the index, just so they can reach more on an instrument or the piano, things like that. Bit of extra supination, pronation, so that rotation in the forearm is great for a lot of instrumentalists, but you certainly don't want hypermobility in the shoulders because that's not advantageous because, you know, your fingers and your forearm, those muscles sort of need a strong foundation, and your foundation comes from your shoulder joint and your scapula, your shoulder blade. So yeah, just like dancers, you want nice hip and some ankle hypermobility. That's where you want it. You sort of don't want too much knee. You want your knee to be nice and strong to be that link. Your lower limbs as strong as all your weakest link. And midfoot is an interesting one. A lot of midfoot compensations, especially if you don't have the hypermobility in the ankle. And so, yeah, that's a nice big cohort of dancers, especially pre-professional, that have a lot of midfoot hypermobility and not coming from the ankle. So, yeah, it depends on the joint and what that function of the joint is. So ideally, you don't want major weight-bearing joints to be super hypermobile. That's a general thing with musicians, but you want the wrist to be hypermobile.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's almost exactly the same for dancers, but with the lower limb.
Yeah.
Cool. Performing artists.
Yeah.
Is how do I know if I'm hypermobile? How do we know?
How do we know? Well, the quick and dirty, most of us know the Bighton score, which is, you know, the hyperextended elbows, the knee, the thumb to the forearm, those, and, you know, standing up and palm to floor. So that's a quick, dirty 20-second test. In research, we've sort of given it a big slap on the wrist because it doesn't do a lot of things, but it was never designed that way. It was really quick designed to see whether someone is hypermobile or not, in terms of a general perspective, because it's trying to capture big joints. But for a dancer, we do recommend people getting assessed using the lower limb assessment scale, and that assesses the hips in multiple directions, and the knee and all the ankle and foot joints. So that is probably a better scale. And so with dancers, if you get 7 out of the 12 tests positive, then you have lower limb and generalized joint hypermobility.
I definitely use that one in my pre-point assessments. And it's very, I guess, takes a lot of practice to get it right. If you are a physiotherapist listening, like, there are a lot of very specific instructions about positioning the joint to make sure that you're doing the test correctly.
Yeah.
But also, like, I find it when I'm with my patients, it's one of the first things that I do in, so for example, a pre-point assessment. But I then find I have to do a lot of explaining around it as well. And I think going back to what you were saying before, explaining that it's not a disadvantage, it can actually be an advantage. Why is it useful? It's useful to know which joints are more hypermobile so that I can give you strengthening exercises that are specific to those areas, et cetera, et cetera. But I find that it can be quite a confusing concept for a lot of patients, and they get a bit worried when I start. Yeah.
They can get worried during the testing because they're like, oh my God, you're doing no one's done. Because everyone's, if they're coming to you, they've done the Bighton for sure, but the lower limb assessment, they haven't. But I feel like the conversations that it opens is very useful for them. Like when we go, look at these tests, all these tests that we've done that are positive are all in a certain plane of movement. We're like, okay, so if all of them are in this certain plane, the sagittal plane, for example, so your flexion extensions, your dorsiflexion, plantar flexions, then have we got any strengthening exercises that target them? And we look at your exercise program. No, nothing. So, you know, that's where we have to put some in. And or, if, you know, what I usually find is the rotatory ones that people are hypermobile and have nothing for. And so that, you know, the massive gap in their rehab or in their strengthening program, whatever it may be. And so they're like, no wonder my ankle's not getting better. And because your hypermobility is in a certain direction and you've been given exercises that don't target that at all. And so it's got nothing to do with, like, and actually they're really relieved. They go, oh, it's not just me and there is hope, you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a good message for, you know, physios treating dancers, and a good reminder for me as well. Like, when I'm, all of us. Yeah, to make sure that we're looking at the different directions of force and, whether you're strengthening somebody into rotation as well as the up and down or side to side kind of thing. Yeah, I'm thinking about the ankle. There are some really good examples with that one. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because it's the foot, you know, the foot and the ankle joint, they're so complex because they have so many little joints. With the Bighton score, I'm also interested in your opinion. So I've been told before that it's not actually valid for people who are under 16, but like what is your take on that?
Probably an evidence-based take on that is we need to be using cutoffs that are age and gender appropriate. Age and sex. Sex is your biological status. So, because that determines more your anthropometry and all of that. So a few years ago now, we published a data set, an Australian data set across the lifespan. And we actually found that the common cutoff of 4 or more should only be reserved for us, like women that are 30 to 49. And males that are 40 and above or something like that. I've forgotten off the top of my head, but it's a specific age group in both the sexes. And so if you're below 14, you need to be way higher. If you're a female, you need to get 6 out of 9, and you're male, you need 5 out of 9. Then plus on the dancing factor, because you've got dance training, you're more hypermobile than the average population. So you add one to that, you need to get 7 out of 9. So, you know, it's much higher for that young dancing cohort.
Yeah, that's really important to consider, I think. Yeah.
So that paper will be really useful. Singh et al. 2017, I think.
Cool. Oh. You've got the references off the top of your head.
I've had enough times.
You're walking big bibliography.
Great. God.
That's good. I probably am too, to be fair.
You will be.
So I guess, you know, my next question was, you know, are there any special things hypermobile dancers need to do to perform well and stay healthy? But I think we've covered the main sort of approach there, which would be to just stay strong.
I think we have. But the thing is, I think don't always, okay, performing artists are very in tune with their body. Great. We know that. We've actually got a few studies in musicians, and I'm probably sure there are a few in dancers that dancers and musicians are very aware, and that's great, because it, you know, early awareness is how you dress things. But I feel like with both dancers and musicians, they always think stretching is the solution to everything. And if you're hypermobile in a joint, it's unlikely that stretching it will make it feel better. It will probably make it feel better in the short term. Mm-hmm. It's not going to solve the problem. So I think just be very careful that if hypermobility is a problem, and it's the problem for a particular joint and it's playing up, be very careful with excessive stretching. And there's also why you might feel that joint is tight. So that's an important thing. Just because your joint's tight, it could be the muscles that are shortened. Yes, it could be the capsule that is more tight than usual. But if you're hypermobile, that's unlikely. But it could be your muscles might be high tone. So it might be protecting the joint, because the joint already went into excessive mobility. So it's trying to protect it. So you need to be careful that you're not actually removing the protection mechanism.
Mm.
And so I think needing to know when to stretch and when not to stretch is important. And when you don't know, do see a healthcare professional like a physio, who can sort of have a good thorough assessment of you to see whether, stretching is not your solution right now. Actually, let's strengthen a certain set of muscles, and that will bring the muscles that are spasming and protecting the joint down in its tone, and you won't feel tight anymore. Or it could be a nutrition issue if it's happening in more than one joint and it's systemic. So I think if it's not working, don't keep using stretching for a long period of time to solve your problem, because if it is a shortened muscle and you stretch it for couple of times, then the problem should be solved. But if it's not changing, don't keep bashing it with stretching.
Yeah, that's a good piece of advice. Yeah. And so you mentioned nutrition before. Like, does hypermobility affect other parts of the body as well? Like digestion,
interesting, because hypermobility is related to connective tissue, and mm-hmm. connective tissue is in nearly every system of the body. But I sort of mentioned before that most people with hypermobility are asymptomatic, and that could be a single joint, multi joint. So these people, usually that could just be happening in the joint. But then there are some people where this hypermobility do extend beyond the musculoskeletal system and is more systemic. And so for these people with more systemic hypermobility, it can affect their gut. So it affects their gut mobility, affects absorption and things like that. And it could extend to your vascular, so blood pressure, and affecting, you know, if you're changing positions from lying to standing and sitting, things like that, so you can get orthostatic intolerance. So yeah, it can extend beyond just the muscle joint system and affect gut. And so absorption can be a problem. Mm-hmm. And IBS is often the first thing people recognize if they do have something that's beyond just the muscle bone joint system.
Yeah, okay. And so, like, who would a dancer see if they were worried that their hypermobility was maybe affecting their digestion?
Probably the first, if you're seeing a physio already, then a physio could run through the 2017 Ehlers-Danlos syndrome type criteria very briefly. Physios can't diagnose, but we can at least go, identify, yeah, you do have things that are beyond just the muscle joint system. And then then your physio can make a recommendation to potentially be seen by a rheumatologist or a clinical geneticist who can run further tests to see what other systems might be affected. And obviously you need to get a referral from your GP for that, those tests. But if, you know, at the end of the day, if it's really just nutrition, then obviously directly see your dietitian and nutritionist.
Yeah. I think that's really important advice too. So I guess Ehlers-Danlos is a type of hypermobility. How would you classify Ehlers-Danlos syndrome?
Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is a heritable disorder of connective tissue. So it sort of falls under this big umbrella term, and it sort of with Marfan syndrome, Lewis-Dietz and osteogenesis imperfecta. So where it's a systemic, usually it's got a genetic marker, and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome has 13 types. Unfortunately, the one that I researched, the hypermobility type, is the one with no genetic marker yet. International study trying to look for it, but all the other types. So the good thing though, hypermobility Ehlers-Danlos syndrome doesn't increase mortality and things like that. But some of the other types are very serious, can lead to earlier death and higher mortality.
Yeah, that's important to be aware of. The things that, you know, your physio might ask might direct them to refer you to a GP first, I guess, and then the GP would determine whether referral to a rheumatologist would be a good idea. So a rheumatologist is like, I guess, a joint doctor. They specialize in like arthritic conditions and things like that. Yeah.
That's right. Well, and dancers usually are very high functioning. So usually don't have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, but that's the absolute end of the spectrum. You can have something in between. So we call that hypermobility spectrum disorder. So you don't quite meet the criteria for Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, but you still have connective tissue or collagen issues that go beyond the musculoskeletal system.
And I've also heard, Clifton, too, that mental health concerns can be somewhat more prevalent in people who are hypermobile. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, there's increasing evidence in the last 4 or 5 years of this. I wouldn't say it's definitive, but the evidence, and it's quite strong and building, that in terms of depression, potentially even autism, so anxiety, a lot of the mental health issues have some type of link with people with a systemic collagen deficiency.
Okay.
All these disorders like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Yeah.
So they would be sort of other things to look out for. But again, it is possible to be hypermobile and not have.
Absolutely. And that would be the majority. And, you know, with that research, why I say you can't definitively say is, it's almost the bird, you know, the chicken and the egg, you know, did you have the condition and then build it, or, you know, your depression and anxiety and all of that has been like increasing over the years. And then you got diagnosed and you're like, oh, these things affect each other, or, you know, it's just hard to say.
The causal link.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Or you're already more prone to having depression and anxiety because of the condition. Yeah, it's hard to 100% say, but the research is showing that going that way.
Yeah. Okay. So watch this space, in other words.
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to add? Any other messages that you would like to add for young dancers, their parents and teachers?
I think young dancers should enjoy themselves.
That's a really good message.
Yes, absolutely. Hypermobile or not, have fun. And, you know, if you're hypermobile, it's something fixable. It's so easily fixed. You've got healthcare professionals like yourself who are so passionate about hypermobility and about fitness and strengthening. And it's something that's very fixable and doable. And so if you've got it, it's absolutely not the end of the world. And even if you're symptomatic, which is the minority, then people like you can absolutely treat it and keep it under wraps for an entire career. And probably the best message I can give is dancers who continue training in dance and doing, you know, warm-ups and all that, even throughout life into their 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s, their health is immaculate. It's when they stop training and stop doing exercise, stop being active, that things fall apart. So I would suggest that if, you know, you love dancing, keep it up and don't stop.
Keep moving.
Keep moving.
Yeah. No, that's excellent advice, Clifton. Thank you. So my last question usually to my guests is, what is your preferred pair of pointe shoes? But would prefer to provide a review on a ballet that he has seen recently.
Yes. I saw American in Paris in Melbourne when it came out, and I brought some of my friends who've never been to ballets before. And I thought, oh, this would be a really good way of introducing them to the ballet world. And I was absolutely completely blown away. I never been to a musical ballet and always thought, oh yeah, it's a bit like the music world's on Andre Rieu. You know, it's all, you know, very showy, a bit flashy. I didn't know what to think of it, but I should really be careful saying that before. But anyway, it was really good. All my friends absolutely loved it. The music was amazing. The singing, I'm, you know, being a musician, the singing was important for me. And I'm going, wow, these dancers can sing as well. So very impressed.
Are you a Gershwin fan?
I actually am. But the thing is, I don't know whether I was just a fan of the dancing. I mean, you know, yeah. I've seen multiple other ballets before, and I've seen countless hours of ballet dancers rehearsing and dancing when I'm doing my research. But I was actually equally mesmerized by music, set and dancing, all three. So none of one like sort of stood out, which I thought was the perfect balance. I really, really enjoyed the whole time.
There you go. I think that's an excellent way to finish our conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge. And so, Clifton, you still treat as well in Sydney. So if you are in Sydney, you can see Clifton the physio. And I'll put some details in the show notes for anybody who would like to catch up with Clifton in real life.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time. Have a good afternoon.
You too.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.